You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'm Mike Hansen, Senior Fellow and Deputy Director in the Brown Center on Education Policy, and we're pleased to have you join us today for this event on bringing education disparities to the forefront of the political debate. This event is being recorded and live-streamed over the brookings.edu website, and I welcome those joining us from remotely for this discussion. Our objective in convening today's event is to stimulate a conversation on a very critical topic, both for today and for the economic prosperity of our country. I think we'd all agree that a quality education and a person's level of education attainment are important determinants of an array of outcomes for individuals and also for our country's competitiveness overall. Yet we're all familiar with the many inequalities present in our public education system. And coincidentally for this event, we just had a release yesterday from the Office of Civil Rights. They released data on a new round of data collection, though I imagine this will be part of our conversation later today. Among other things, let me just highlight a couple things that this data shows. Black children, particularly black males, are suspended or expelled from school at disproportionately high rates. Number two, black and Latino students have lower levels of access to AP or advanced math and science courses. And third, black, Latino, and Native American students have disproportionately higher rates of math and, of chronic student absenteeism and attend schools with high concentrations of inexperienced and or unlicensed teachers. Though there is general agreement among researchers, policymakers, and the public, both about the importance of education and these persistent gaps in public education by race, this is a topic that often takes a low priority in prominent public debates and has also taken a particularly low prominence in this current election cycle. On the right, most of the discussion has been about abandoning the Common Core. On the left, most discussion has focused on the cost of lowering the cost of college. And while these are two hot topics and flashpoint topics, the depth and range of issues in education is much more vast than those two topics, and particularly against the backdrop of persistent inequality in the economy, which is a very hot-button issue this election cycle, it's curious that the topic of education's contributions to those inequalities continues to elude those debates. And so I trust that this will be an engaging conversation this afternoon. And I invite those both here in the audience and those who are joining us online to join in the live Twitter conversation using hashtag education disparities, all one word. And I will be participating here on this panel with four other esteemed individuals from various backgrounds, and let me introduce them to you. On my furthest left, your far right, we have DeRay McKesson. DeRay is a protester and a community organizer and co-founder of Campaign Zero, and has taken a leading role in the Black Lives Matter movement. DeRay's background comes from public schools. He was a Teach for America Corps member in New York and then worked in the offices of the Harlem Children's Zone, as well as in the district offices as a senior human resources director in Minneapolis Public Schools before becoming a full-time activist. Next, we have Gerard Robinson. Gerard Robinson is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Among his many notable positions, Mr. Robinson previously served as the State Secretary of Education in both Florida and Virginia. Next to my immediate left here is Peggy McLeod, who is the Deputy Vice President of Workforce Development at the National Council of La Raza. Dr. McLeod has spent her career in public education, working as a teacher in Puerto Rico, as well as working in administrative capacities in federal and district education agencies. Much of her work has focused on programs with English language learners. And then finally, to my right, Aaliyah Wong will moderate today's conversation. Aaliyah is an award-winning journalist and the editor of the Atlantic's education section. She was previously a reporter on the education beat in Honolulu and holds degrees in journalism and Latin American studies from Boston University. Welcome to everyone for today's event. And with that, I'll turn the time over to you, Aaliyah.
Well, thank you, everyone, for being here today. When I was first invited to moderate this panel, I was like, how the heck am I going to focus a conversation on educational disparities in an hour? I mean, we could be here for weeks. It's educational disparities are pretty much 90%, even 100% of what I cover as an education journalist. But I think that's the beauty of this conversation today, is that it can really take its own shape and we can really touch on a lot of the maybe more overlooked issues. So you spoke about the DOE data that was released yesterday, the civil rights data, and it really kind of reiterates just the myriad factors that contribute to these disparities in education, from chronic absenteeism to discipline rates to access to advanced courses. In your opinion, what are some of the more ignored factors or the overlooked factors that are contributing to this achievement gap that we should be paying more attention to? And I think each of you have your own perspective on this issue. So let's start with you.
Start with me, okay. I am a teacher researcher guy. That's what I focus a lot of my research on. And we're all familiar with the achievement gaps between white and non-white students in the United States. And one of the factors that I would argue contributes to those gaps is the diversity or lack thereof in the public teacher workforce. Educators and researchers have long pointed to the importance of students having similar role models to them as teachers or other invested adults in their lives. And what this research shows, and some of which has been highlighted on the Brown Center chalkboard, is that same-race teachers tend to promote greater student achievement. They tend to have more positive expectations of minority student performance. They are less likely to view students' misbehavior as problematic and therefore less likely to end up in taking suspension or expulsion measures. They also have more positive, there are various other factors that contribute to this. And also, as a result of this research, many agree, as I do myself, that a teacher workforce that really reflects the diversity of the student population would be valuable for public students overall. Yet I'm working on a report here in the with some collaborators from the National Council on Teacher Quality. This report is not quite released yet, but it will be released here through the Brown Center in the coming weeks. And what we're interested in this report is examining what it will take to achieve a national teacher workforce that is as diverse as the student body, as the students that they're serving, and how long that diverse workforce will take to achieve. And I'm just going to give you a quick sneak peek of what those findings say. First, the punchline is that not only my children, but my children's children will already be through their public schooling before they can expect to see a fully diverse teacher workforce. And the reason for this is sort of two-pronged. Number one is that looking over the next 40-odd years, student demographic trends toward increasing diversity in the United States. Whites will become less prominent, and by the year 2060, we expect roughly equal shares of whites and Hispanics among the student population. The representation of blacks will be roughly the same as what they currently are, about 15% or so. So where we have a current diversity problem among teachers, where more than 80% of teachers are white, we have a target that is going to be moving increasingly away from us. So that's the first prong of the problem. The second prong of the problem is that we have a problem getting minority teachers into the classroom, and once they're there, keeping them there. To become a teacher, you need to meet qualifications to go through this long process. And with my co-authors, we looked at data to look at the various points of the teacher pipeline. And everywhere that we looked and where we could find data, we basically found a white, non-white gap between teacher candidates. And so, of course, we're all familiar with gaps in college enrollment and degree attainment between whites and non-whites, and that, of course, contributes to how qualified they are to become teachers. But then, of course, there are gaps in who decides to become an education major between whites and non-whites. There are gaps in licensure test scores. There are gaps in who actually gets a job in the classroom. There are gaps in who among education majors say they actually want to become a teacher as a profession. Once they're in the classroom, we tend to lose minority teachers at higher rates than we lose white teachers. Of course, this is partially due to the context in which minority teachers are teaching, which tend to be in predominantly disadvantaged settings. However, we can't have a revolving door of minority teachers if we want to develop a diverse workforce. Combined, all these factors make it extremely difficult for the workforce to diversify quickly enough to match the speed of the quickly diversifying student body over time. So we need to not only patch up all the holes in the teacher pipeline, but we'd actually have to do some type of affirmative action type of selection and retention policies to make workforce diversity a possibility within a generation. Otherwise, it's based on the numbers that we're looking at, it's just not happening. And so while we do need, while we wait for a more diverse workforce to develop, I argue that we need to be thinking about policies that we could put in place that give students a more diverse public education experience now, even without the workforce diversity being there quite yet. And so we need to get creative with solutions, and here are a couple of potential solutions. Number one, we could make sure that other adults in the school buildings are diverse, which may be easier to achieve in the near future. So we could think of administrators, teaching paraprofessionals, librarians, gym coaches, education leaders, basically any other adults in the building that develop and maintain relationships with students to help them promote and learn more in the classroom. Another idea would be to better train and provide professional development about subtle biases among teachers and looking at the dynamics between students and teachers. Of course, many of the biases that teachers hold, these are going to be unintentional biases. I'm not implicating anybody of being intentionally biased about the way they're interacting with their kids, but by talking about and becoming aware of these implicit biases that may arise, educators might be able to put solutions into place that help to mitigate those biases and look for creative solutions to stop those biases from arising, to counter situations where they could unintentionally arise.
Great. And Peggy, what about you?
Well, why don't I take that and talk about Latinos Latino education, and more precisely the demographic imperative that Latino education and Latino children pose for this country. Maybe to set the context, we can talk a little bit about what are some of the numbers of Latinos. Right now, about a quarter of all students in the United States, a quarter of kids in early childhood programs are Latinos. 32% of kids from the ages of 0 to 2 are dual language learners, which means that they're hearing another or speaking another language in their home. However, there continue to be serious gaps in Latino access to an early childhood program. Not only is access a problem, but access to high quality programming is a serious problem for our community. The gaps, even though the enrollment of Latino kids in early childhood programs grew from one-third participation to 52% between 2007 and 2012, it still lags considerably behind other groups. A good thing is that last week the White House issued for the first time a policy statement on dual language learners, which suggested talked about the research that shows the appropriate programming for these kids in two languages is the better way to go in terms of pedagogy. It's also the better way to go in terms of family ties. When you stop speaking your native language, you're not able to communicate with your grandparents anymore. A lot of you have experienced it yourselves. And so maintaining that first language is really important. And then there's an economic opportunity there that we just have not tapped into. All these immigrants that come in with another language, and we think that our job is to take that language away and replace it with English. And it's increasingly dumb idea to do this, considering the global economy in which we operate. So that was a really good thing to happen. In K-12, again, a quarter of all students are Latinos. As you know, in several states, it's over half of students are Latinos. And good news is that recently the latest graduation rates came out 76.3%, highest it's ever been for Latinos. Dropout rate has gone down considerably. In fact, that graduation rate actually exceeds the national rate of improvement. So we're improving. Latino kids are improving their graduation rates at a higher pace than any other group. Bad news, 11% of states graduate less than 70% of Latinos. And there continues to be on NAEP, both in the reading and math scores, there continues to be significant gaps of over 20 points in fourth grade and eighth grade between Latinos, between Hispanic kids and white kids. So there are still significant gaps in terms of other kids. In higher ed, Latinos now represent the largest minority group on campuses. Of course, as the high school graduation rates have increased, the college enrollment rates have also increased. So right now, there are a lot of Latinos in colleges in the United States. The bad news, they're not graduating in 4 years. First of all, they're enrolling predominantly in two-year institutions, and then the retention rates are very low. There's still significant lag there in achieving college graduation.
What about you, Gerard?
Disparities in education are real. The civil rights data that was produced yesterday shocked some people. For others, it was a yawn. This is 2016. If we take that data and link it to what the Government Accountability Office released May 17th, 62 years after the Supreme Court ruled in Brown v. Board, they found something very similar. Some were shocked, some yawned. If we want to have an honest conversation about racial disparities, we often have the conversation of white-black score difference, Hispanic-white difference. We rarely have conversations about a gap that exists, Asian-white. I hear a few amens out there. But even when you look at Asian-white, within the Asian population, there are disparities. And yet we refer to the Asian students as the model minority. You obviously have not spoken to a lot of Hmong families who have a lot of challenges, and not saying that all members of the Hmong community are not excelling, because many are. Koreans, Chinese, Japanese, Laotians, others. There is a difference within groups. We rarely talk about the white differences in achievement. I live in Virginia. I'm proud to say that we have one of the best public school systems in the United States. I'm happy to say that we have a number of our graduates who go to great institutions, state and private. If you look at Virginia and you look at the number of people age 25 and older who at least have a bachelor's degree, arguably we find ourselves number 7 in the nation, being the 7th smartest in the country, and we cheer. And yet, if you take a physical horseshoe and you put it on the map of Virginia, where we physically have a horseshoe, where there's a great deal of poverty, a great deal of socioeconomic challenges, and a great deal of economic and educational challenges. If you take the horseshoe and you made it its own state, it would rank 50th in terms of achievement and in the bottom tier for socioeconomic parity in the same state. And this impacts a lot of low-income and working-class white families. It's tough to have the conversations without also talking about white families. So for me, we need to have an intra-race conversation. That's part one. Part of the challenge with dealing with discrepancies depends on how you define it. Here's a perfect example. Our American population, we make up 5% of the world, and we make up 35% of the Nobel laureates. When we say, how did that happen? We call it American exceptionalism. And I think there are many exceptional things about America. When African-American students make up 16% of the public school population and make up nearly 40% of the suspensions, what do we call that? A statistical anomaly. Interesting. But you didn't say that about the 35% for Nobel laureates. We have to be honest and get serious about defining what the problem is and what it is not. And so for me, I'm still optimistic that 62 years removed from Brown v. Board, we are stronger. We've got some better results than we would have had without that decision. Are there challenges still? Absolutely. But public policy alone won't change it, and we cannot expect our public schools to do it alone. I support what I call a civil society approach, where you bring in faith-based communities, nonprofits, for-profits, and others who can say, look, what can we do to wrap our arms around schools, teachers, educators, and families to help the process. So for me, it's a definition challenge.
And just to piggyback off of what you were saying about Asian Americans, the DOE only recently decided to disaggregate data on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. So until now, a Native Hawaiian student would be bracketed in the same group as an Indian student. And that data really glossed over a lot of the nuances. So I think that's, you know, a really important point. And DeRay, what is your answer to the
Yes, yeah, so I fundamentally think of this work as justice work, that is obviously so much of the work of the movement, but we know that the disparities that Black kids in America have always faced have been so different and have been so deeply rooted in the racist history of the country. When I think about this, it is tinged by my own experience as a teacher. You know, I taught sixth grade math and I was a senior leader in two public school districts. I was a chapter leader for the UFT in New York City and worked at Home Children's Zone, worked in after school. Like, I believe in all those things. But I'll say that I worry about a lot of things when we think about this. I think that there has to be a real commitment to public education. I think that we've seen, I think charter schools are important part of the puzzle. If we think about what a charter means, is this idea that if we lower constraints, that should increase innovation. And if we increase innovation, that should lead to increased results. Like, I think that's at the root of what the charter school idea is, whether you like that in practice or not. Again, when that's not happening, I think we struggle. When we see entire school districts sort of move to an effort to privatize or whatever, and like the results aren't actually there for our kids, I think that's like a real challenge, and I think that we've seen that across the country. And I do think that, you know, sort of pushing on this idea of the achievement gap, the language of it, I think it focuses on Black people partly because like this country's relationship to Black people has been so different. And I think that in that there is an understanding that if we address that head on, that other groups will also benefit too, right? And I think that's like a real thing. When I think about sort of how I think that we spend a lot of work, I spend most of my time talking about the police, and Lord knows we talk about the problems there. Sort of what does it look like to talk about solutions, and what do those buckets look like? I think about it in three buckets. One is around classrooms. Like, if the question becomes, how do we make sure that every kid has a great teacher every day, and how do we do that at scale? Like, I think that's at the heart of what this work is. The first bucket is deeply rooted in classrooms, and that's about how do we find the best teachers, how do we train the best teachers, and how do we retain the best teachers. Like, I think that is at work. What we know to be true is not only is there a teacher shortage, but very few districts across the country actually have a mechanism to hire teachers well. Like, it is, you know, it's like a black hole in terms of hiring teachers. I think on Baltimore, we hired about 800 teachers a year. In Minneapolis, we hired about 400 teachers a year. Very few districts make it easy. Like, if you apply as like a candidate and you go through the system, I mean, it's not easy. It's much harder than it has to be. And then we think about teacher prep programs. You know, I was a Teacher America core member. I've never been an employee of Teacher America. That's, you know, I get all these articles about my affiliation with Teacher America. But I will say, for all the critics of Teacher America, which they should be criticized for things, it's an imperfect organization, is that it is an indictment of teacher prep programs that somebody who's trained in 6 weeks does as well as somebody who is trained in 4 years, right? That's not an indictment of Teacher America when we think about the results. And how do we have more programs that actually like recruit people and prepare people to do well? I think about it as somebody who's hired and who's managed staffing in two public school districts. It's really hard when we work with our university partners where every single person gets a 4.0. Everybody got an A. I'm calling around trying to figure out who's a better teacher. Everybody's great. And you're like, okay, well, that is interesting when I'm getting like 80 resumes from one program, 100 resumes, and literally every single person in the program got a 4.0. And like what that means for the way that we prepare and the way that we would match candidates with schools was like actually really difficult at the district level. And again, like we experienced, someone talked about teacher turnover. We had about 10% teacher turnover a year. A lot of teachers needed to hire in a way at scale that is actually just really hard for most districts, definitely big districts. The second is about schools and how do we make sure schools are fit environments for kids. I think about so much of that is like the culture work, and I've seen districts. I think about in Minneapolis, you know, a couple of years ago, we had that consent decree where we couldn't suspend kindergartners anymore. It's like one of the biggest pieces of news. And one of the hard things about that, while I agree with that, that makes sense to me, is that what we found in our schools is that some people, all of a sudden, everybody was like restorative justice, right? They're like, every school's restorative justice. And I'm sitting here like, I was a teacher, and restorative justice actually requires like a strong community at the beginning, right? Like, you don't walk into a school, you're like, restorative justice. And that's what people started to do, though. They're like, restorative justice. You're like, what? This is a nightmare. Like, that's not it. And how do we actually like support schools to think about culture in a way that is true to that school and that is culturally relevant, that makes sense, that has the right incentives? And I would sit in meetings and, you know, the polar bucks or whatever, like the dollars, and teachers would be like, that enforces capitalism. And you're like, y'all, this is, I don't know what behavior is going to look like in your classroom, right? Like, we have to actually have real conversations about this. And I do worry about some of the things that are really popular, like restorative justice, not because I worry about it as a tool. I think it's really powerful. I also know that it requires really strong community to be built upon. Like, you don't get kids in a circle to talk about penalties if you like can't get them to sit down. Like, that doesn't work. And I think that people have become really theoretical about some of the work in education, and that worries me. The third is about systems. I will say that my bias is about system work. I believe in programs. As somebody who worked at one of the largest after-school programs in the country, went back to Baltimore, opened one, I believe in that stuff. What I've seen happen in too many cities, especially places like Baltimore, is that programs come in and they do all this sort of mildly okay work. Outcomes don't really change, but the focus on programs actually shifts the focus away from systems. Like, people sort of stop fighting for system change because they're like, we got that great after-school program on reading. And you're like, well, the school system is actually really, really poor at teaching kids how to read, and, like, you need to keep pressing them. And that great little, like, you know, 25-person reading program is amazing, but, like, is not a solution at scale. And, like, we have to figure out how to do both and in the work, and I think that sometimes the language for programming sort of veers too far and people lose a focus on the systems. The last things I'll say is, you know, I think that we, some of the things that worry me, I think that, like, the opt-out movement worries me with the impact that it'll have on Black kids and kids of color in general. I get that this push around, I get that some people are like, testing is insert here, right? I think that when you ask parents, though, it's like, you know, my kids should go to a good school is what parents would say, and that I should be able to understand what good means. Like, I think that is real. And the question becomes, like, how do we operationalize that in a way that doesn't sort of unduly burden teachers and that really gives people information that they can act on? And I think that that's where the work is, but I think that what is real about No Child Left Behind and all the data that came out around subsets is that we just wouldn't know about so many subsets if we didn't have that data, and we need that. And I've seen too many people in community sort of say, well, we knew it was bad, and da-da-da, and they have these stories, which are really powerful, and I'm a believer in stories. The movement is based on stories. I get it. But sometimes we need to be able to, like, drill down to the kid level so that we can actually support people in ways that will really close gaps. And we think about the gaps. The reality is that we've let these gaps fester for so long. So I don't know what it looks like if we actually don't get everybody to grade level as, like, as a concrete strategy. You think about cities like Baltimore, 40% of the adults cannot functionally read. That, like, the K-12 issue is only a part of the puzzle in a place like Baltimore. That, like, that many adults who can't read is wild, you know? Like, we could bring every industry we want to the city, and, like, that many adults not being able to read is, like, a really wild thing. So I think that most of the solutions that I think will have impact are probably, like not the most sexy things. Things like home visiting programs where we give kids libraries. Like, I think those sort of things will be the real things. And we think about reparations, which I know is, like, a hot topic word for people, but sort of reframing as this idea of acknowledge and repair. And what it means to focus on the racial history of the country is, like, an acknowledgement that I think changes the way we think about repair. So as a Black person, as a Black man, you know, I'm a third generation reader. My great-grandmother could sign her name, and she was incredibly proud of that. But what does it mean to be from a family where I'm the third generation of people who can read? That, like, means something in the way that we think about how to prepare people. And that requires us to understand the racial history in a deeper way.
Great. Well, it's clear from what a lot of what was just said is that a big piece of the puzzle in solving this issue involves teachers. And you folks highlighted a number of problems, diversity, retention, turnover. Another really big challenge when trying to close these achievement gaps is figuring out how to get the highest quality teachers into the highest poverty and most struggling schools. Some districts have tried bonuses or other types of incentives, but I think, you know, from what I've read, those have had pretty limited success. So in your opinion, how do we get those teachers into the into the struggling schools?
I take it you're looking at me, and I will...
Everyone. I want everyone to answer.
Okay.
Let's start with you.
First off, my assertion is that by paying teachers more for teaching in high-need schools, this is commonly referred to as combat pay. In general, those kinds of incentives, they can work if they are large enough and if they are, if they're consistent enough over time. By and large, what we've generally seen is that there is a lot of resistance to paying teachers differential amounts because of the schools in which they are teaching. And so there's generally union resistance to that premise. But I personally see no reason that we shouldn't, and I feel like that would be a step in the right direction. Of course, other things that we could do that are not necessarily directly related to paying teachers based on where they're teaching, we could also just think of perhaps giving different teachers different roles in those schools. And so, for example, if we wanted to hire more master teachers, like we have an innovative school staffing system in these particular schools where there we only allow master teachers to come to fill 25% of positions, for example. And master teachers come with, you know, a certain set of criteria in order to be there. It becomes a selective thing. Anybody can do it, but only specific schools are eligible for those kinds of positions. And so we could try to be a little bit creative, but I think we could get around some of the collective bargaining resistance to this differential pay. And I think that would do a great deal to attract and keep good teachers there.
Peggy, what do you think? Particularly, I know there's a shortage of ELL teachers and, mm-hmm. and teachers who speak a foreign language. So particularly with those types of teachers, which as you've illustrated are pretty critical to supporting English language learners, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the sad kind of a paradox for the Latino community is the fact that we, number one in every poll, Latinos identify as number one or number two, education is a big issue. And so teachers typically in the countries where we come from are held in very high regard. You know, whatever the teacher says is what goes at home. And, I mean, certainly it was that way with me. I mean, if the teacher said anything to me, it didn't matter what my opinion was, that's what went. And so it's interesting that more Latinos don't go into education. I think it's because education is so devalued here. So when you get to college, when you listen, the last 10 years have been a total assault on teachers. You know, we've managed to devalue the profession to such a point where I was a teacher, I would not want to become a teacher. It's an increasingly difficult job. It's even more difficult if you're teaching certain groups of kids who might have additional needs, if you're working in a high poverty school. And so I think we're facing a real crisis because we don't really know it right now, but there's increasing numbers of teachers retiring. There are a lot of states that have slashed their budgets and so are paying their teachers poorly and can't get enough teachers. If you go to Kansas, all their teachers have left and gone to Missouri because they get paid better there. So I think we have this huge problem. I think that the teacher pay issue is enormous, and I think that the solution is to start teachers. When I started teaching, you know, you started making $30,000, and maybe at the end of your career, you'd retire and you were making $90,000, which, you know, pretty good deal, right? But meanwhile, you had to go through this long ladder. What happens with physicians, for example? They graduate, and they don't start at $30,000 and then work their way up to $200,000. They start at a much higher level, and then the curve to go up to their highest earnings isn't that long as it is for teachers. So in traditional public schools, and even in charter school, we radically have to reform the way teachers are paid. Teachers don't work until 3 o'clock like people think and then go home. That just doesn't happen. And any of you who have ever taught know that that's the case. And so I don't think that we can make teaching attractive to anyone in this country until we have some basic changes in the way we look at teachers, the way we value the work that they do, because it is the most important work. And in this country, we just don't value that. You know, we want to look at people who are stingers or, you know, sports people or whatever. I think we have to have a radical departure about the way we talk about teachers, the way we do teacher preparation programs, and everything else related to bringing people into the profession.
Gerard, do you have any thoughts on getting good teachers into struggling schools?
So there was an evaluation of a program in the state of North Carolina that provided additional money to teachers who would go into the hard-to-serve areas, and results show that for the teachers who were able to participate, there was actually an uptick in student results, and so that was a good sign. But more importantly, those teachers were more likely to stay. So there are examples out there that are pointing in the right direction. That's number one. Number two, we know that students who are in classes with nationally board-certified teachers actually do pretty well. And there's a debate over whether all teachers should have it or not. We know that it's a club that you have to earn your way into. And so I would like to see ways for state lawmakers not only to provide the financial support to nationally board-certified teachers, but also incentives for them to either transfer to hard-to-serve schools or, if they're in a school already, to stay. But those answers really are about quality. The reality is the fertility rate and the fecundity rate in the United States is not strong enough to keep up with the student rate and the number of teachers we'll need. So rather than us trying to birth teachers, we need to invent teachers. Here's an example. There are universities in the country that have innovation labs. And through those innovation labs, they create many things. I know of a university currently who's in relationships, I should say talking to the military, where they can actually scan someone and create a hologram or 3D vision of the person. And that person, for all intents and purposes, are in the same room. So let's take DeRay, who teaches math. We know we need more math teachers. I'm going to scan DeRay. I'm going to put him in the computer. And through the technology we have today, not tomorrow, we can have him appear in 600 classrooms simultaneously teaching math. We can do it for science. There's still lab components, so we need aspects there. But for the social sciences and others, we can do it. When you look at television and what we can do to take people across space and time, we're going to have to do that to take our best and brightest teachers, reinvent them, and spread them across the country.
Right, especially as a recent teacher. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that one of the interesting challenges that this question makes me think of is about like the small school movement, or which I agree with. I think it's important that we open up more schools in general, but it begs the question of like who are going to be those leaders, right? Like it presupposes that there's like this great bench of principals out there, and that is not true. Right. And that makes me think of like you couldn't pay me like $20,000 more to work for a bad principal. It was like teaching is already hard enough, right? Like working with the kids was a challenge, and like it was joyful and amazing, but that was a challenge I like chose. Like crazy adults, it was like you know, like a couple more dollars, like wasn't it? So like it makes sense to me both in my own experience and as a district administrator that like incentivizing it with money, like teachers want to work with good teachers and good principals. That's like it. And like how do we like scale that and sell that story to them better? Like I think about Minneapolis, we could get some teachers to move to really tough schools because they were like, I'm gonna follow that leader. And we're like, cool, right? One of the hard things, though, is there's not a strong bench of school leaders that people want to follow in those schools. And I think that's, like, a real challenge. And if we don't figure that out, like, it is, you know, people often talk about, like, our most inexperienced teachers go into the hardest schools, and the data reflects that, and that is real. I think that is a consequence, though, of, like, you can't convince other people to go there, not because the kids are tough necessarily, but because, like, the work environment is a place that people are like, nah, I'm not going to do that. And people are willing, I think, to take some risks when they are strong leaders and there's like a really good crop of teachers already. But in the absence of that, I think people are like, we're not going to do this. I also, like, I will not downplay, like, it is incredible. The systems that most districts have to bring people on or, like, to look at applications is not very helpful. Like, it's really hard. And that has to be easier. That, like, I can think about some incredible teachers who we had to work really hard to match some of the schools, and we did it because it was a priority, but we missed a lot of people too. So you think about what happens when there are some black men who are teaching and there are not a lot of black men teaching. Like, how do we flag and put them in places, like make sure they interview with teachers or schools that might be better fits? Like, that whole matching process at the district level, especially for big districts, is not very well done. And mostly, you think about places like D.C. In D.C., Chancellor Henderson manages schools, right? She's not managing buses, IT, like she's like managing schools. And in so many other districts, you think about Baltimore, you know, I was managing, I'm trying to recruit a lot of great teachers, but I'm recruiting welders, I'm recruiting electricians, right? We're doing like a whole other thing too, which means that our focus on schools was like a part of it, and that was really important to us, but we had to make sure that somebody like fixed the stairs when they broke, and like, and there are a lot of big districts that really struggle with how to do that work well, and I think that's real. And then, again, I don't think districts recruit nationally well at all. Most districts recruit hyper-locally. Places like Baltimore, places like D.C., places like New York sort of benefit from people making career changes. So, you know, people in human capital will always tell you that if you hire somebody during the summer, it's, like, scary, right? Like, the summer teachers are the teachers who couldn't get hired otherwise. That's, like, whether it's true or not, that is what people say in the work. And these regions sort of benefit because there's normally an influx of talent because people make career changes, so we could sort of hire differently. But the hiring process is normally really early, right? It's like April, May. April, May is when a lot of the sort of best teachers make choices about where they're going to be next year. But very few districts are actually revved up and ready to make hiring decisions in April and May. And I think that that is also like part of our challenge. I think it's like actually pretty logistical.
And then quickly, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask each of you about one of the latest buzzwords that's really popular is grit, and kind of similar to restorative justice. It's you know, it seems like a nice idea, but whether or not it's really the panacea that it's often described as is far from clear. So in you know a minute or less, can each of you give your opinion on grit and whether it's really the life hack we all need?
Do you want to start off?
Sure. Cool. Yes, I've heard the word grit, and I think in theory it sounds great. I think there's some things we want to inculcate in our children that would allow them to demonstrate qualities of grit, but I'm not sure that that's like an answer to everything. I think as many things in education, you know, I've been at this for many, many years, and it's just, you know, it's just like another buzzword with.
Wonder what it's going to be next year.
Right, it'll be something else in a couple of years.
Yeah.
I think one good thing about grit is it has a lot of middle class people, particularly philanthropists, coming up with one word to explain what they're trying to do instead of trying to say it with two or three sentences. So that's a good thing. The other challenge is you only talk about grit if you don't have it. You know, a lot of times conversations about school reform and the words we use are really cocktail conversations for the materially comfortable, because the people who actually have to do this don't call it grit, they call it life. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad it's around.
It's a good kicker.
Yeah, I push and say, you know, I think about, I taught in East New York, Brooklyn, Star City, one of the largest housing projects in the country. It was so big that we had our own zip code. And it was really important that we were really thoughtful about teaching our kids like how to persevere through some of the academic challenges, right? And I taught math. So I would get these kids who are super math phobic. They fail one test and it was like the world, and you're like, okay, it'll be okay. Really, how do I actually like give you the skills so you can like get to the next thing too, right? And you're 11. So I'm really trying to teach you like these concrete strategies that will allow you to come back tomorrow and experience success. Because so much of why our kids struggle it's not that they don't care or aren't smart, but like school isn't always a place where people feel successful. And like as teachers, like how do we actually make it a place, like in math, it was like, how do I make sure that you feel successful every single day, even when you like screw up and you get everything wrong and da-da-da, like how do I get that success? And I think that the grit conversation like gets us closer to being intentional about pushing kids in a world where they can like come back tomorrow. And the classroom is a place where failure like has to be a part of how people learn. You know, I've never failed as much as I ever have as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And kids definitely do as a part of their growth process. And I think that grit is like an important entrance into that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Michael, any thoughts?
Sure. I do echo many of the comments that were already said. And one thing I will add, though, is also I feel like it is helpful in that focusing on grit or focusing on something that's not test score related. I think it has helped to shape this conversation to other important values of education that are part of public schools, that we do value these socio-emotional kinds of outcomes in students. Now, I will also add a caveat to that it's not entirely clear the role of schools or teachers and how those are developed. And I think that's a really interesting research problem to look at. And so in that sense, I'm a little skeptical of current policy focuses in trying to sort of rush into put those into our accountability systems right away, just because I think there's a lot of caution warranted. But I think it's an exciting new development and worth paying attention to.
And it's interesting now that with ESSA, a lot of districts will be measuring social-emotional learning, and how that's going to play out will be fun to watch. Well, that unfortunately wraps up the Q&A portion, so now I'm going to bring it out to the audience. And if you could just say your name and what organization you represent, and try and keep your questions brief, and please make them questions, not statements. So we're going to have people walking around with mics. Let's start with man in the pink shirt. Oh, raspberry, sorry.
Donald Collins, University of Maryland, University College. My question to the whole panel really is about moving beyond sort of this taking the micro, making it macro around teacher quality and teacher effectiveness. Let's all have hero teachers in the work in the field, to really think about more broadly sort of the history of the achievement gap and when it's actually closed. Marion Wright Edelman wrote an article about 44 years ago looking at how the achievement gap closed during the tail end of the civil rights period as a result of all things, school desegregation. And during the years in the 70s and 80s, it actually kind of closed a bit, quite a bit, as a matter of fact, between whites and blacks, whites and Latinos, et cetera, et cetera. Why isn't, I'm asking in so many words, the talk about school desegregation and how that can play a role in taking a lot of the things that we're talking about, experimenting in this here, bringing this to scale there, and talking about structural issues like segregation in schools and residentially and otherwise, and how that can deal with a lot of the achievement gap issues. Thank you.
Let me address that one first. I've done some thinking on this and some writing on this. As you state, and what was your name again?
Donald.
Donald. And as Donald stated, desegregation, of course, there were orders for desegregation following Brown versus Board of Education. Desegregation peaked in the late 80s. And since then, it's been documented that schools have been slowly resegregating over time. We're not quite to the level of segregation that was present at the time of Brown versus Board of Education, but we're actually closer to that than what we were at the peak. So the question is if we are in more integrated schools, are students going to be better off? And the short answer to that question is yes. And the slightly longer answer to that question is, if we're looking at it through the lens of teacher quality, we are better off by being in this integrated school environment, but we're actually not going to be hugely better off. And the reason is because while we do have documented evidence of gaps in licensed professionals or experienced professionals across different school settings, those are gaps in characteristics and qualifications and not quality. And quality and characteristics, they actually don't line up very well. And if you're looking at quality, the gaps are significantly smaller than what we expected. And so while going into an integrated school environment does make a difference, it was on the order of closing the achievement gap by about 3 percentage points based on this study that I was involved with, this teacher quality distribution study. It was funded by IES. And so does it make a difference? The answer is yes. It doesn't make nearly as big of a difference. Now, that's, of course, just the teacher quality dimension. And so there are, of course, school funding dimensions, peer characteristics that also go into this that could also be part of gains that could be made. But desegregation alone, I feel like, at least through teachers, is going to be a relatively minor piece of the puzzle. A good start, but a minor piece.
My plan for closing the achievement gap has always been to make everyone middle class at least, and because then you really eliminate the middle, the achievement gap. And I'm not being flip about this. I really believe that that is the solution to it. And, you know, the economist in me, that's what I studied in undergraduate, says that if you change fiscal policy, if you change economic policy, if you change tax policies, you really can make a big difference in making sure that everybody has a decent living wage and a decent place to live, because, you know, as Donald alluded to, a lot of this is residential segregation, and the desegregation of schools has been fleeting if you look at it over decades, and so the impact of that desegregation is going to be very limited. So we really have to have eliminate the economic segregation in which many of our communities live in.
Woman right here.
Once you get out of the large cities, particularly inner suburbs, school boundaries are set by geography. And geography is set by income inequality. And so since part of this discussion was to be at the national level, what do any of you think, either the Department of Education, Housing, Transportation, should do to press local jurisdictions where you have some schools with 80% of the kids on school and reduced lunch programs and other schools in the same district with none? So my question to you all is, at the federal level, do you see that as a problem? And do you see anything that the next administration, whatever that is, could do to press for a more open school systems?
So you have approximately 22 states that have open enrollment laws, which allow you to go beyond one school zone area to attend another school that's better performing. I wouldn't recommend that the Department of Education, Transportation, or Housing dictate that. If there is to be a federal role, it should be maybe to give an incentive grant to states to say, you know what, I would like to expand the program. Other than financial incentives or a grant piece, I wouldn't recommend the federal government get involved.
Man back there in the blue sweatshirt, the red icon.
Hi, I'm Charlie Wilson from Ohio State University College of Law, where I teach education law and education policy. I have two very quick questions. First of all, we have an enormous gap between what wealthy parents spend on enrichment for their children and what people in the bottom quintile can spend on enrichment. Is that one of the causes of the achievement gap? And my second question is, would it attract teachers, high-quality teachers, into high-need schools to offer, instead of more pay, a sabbatical? Professors like me, every 6 years, it's such hard work teaching these 160 kids who want to be there out of 5,000 applicants that I need a rest every 5 years. It seems to me K through 12 teachers teaching in a high-need school, it would have an enormous ability to attract students, that teachers would really love to do that. They would come back so energized after their sabbatical, and it wouldn't be cheap. But that, I think, would attract a different kind. I guess I'd want your response to where that would attract high-quality teachers into high-needs K through 12 schools.
So starting with the second question, I think that I think sabbatical, and there's some charter schools that do them. I think that's really interesting. I think, I think that solves for like a different, I think that might solve the burnout question. I don't think it solves how to get our highest performing teachers in struggling schools. I firmly believe that people go for good colleagues and good principals. And like, the school environment is so tough in some of our toughest schools that like none of that is gonna have me sit through. You know, I think about some schools, there's a school we had where the principal will walk in and while you were teaching, put post-it notes up and give you feedback during your lesson. Like, I don't wanna work there. Do you know what I mean? And there's no amount of like, oh, give me 4 years, I'm gonna get out. Like, that's not, like, this is like a wild place to be. So that's that. I think about the racial wealth gap, yes. And it's an acknowledgement that like black people aren't poor because they just like were lazy, like that's like not real. So it's like, how do we acknowledge that and then like do a repair that honors the injustice that was done, right? So what would it mean to give every single kid in a birth cohort of like 7,000 their first set of library, their first books when they are born? Like that would actually be like a corrective sort of at the scale level for what it means that there are all these people that can't afford books, right? Or like don't like, and I think that that has to be, reparations is like a, you know, I don't talk about it often because people just lose it about it. But it's like, how do we like acknowledge the injustice and then do some like systemic things that actually repair? I think about, you know, when I was a teacher, we had this parent come in and her kid read on a second grade reading level as a seventh grader. And she was like, well, he reads every night and da da da. And we're sitting here like, he is definitely on a second grade reading level and he's actually really fluent, right? He totally can look at words and repeat them, can't comprehend at all. Like he has no clue what the words mean, mm-hmm. but he can like repeat them. And some of our work had to be building her capacity to do things at home. And like it was easy to teach her like a couple questions she could ask him every night that were like comprehension questions. And like we got him up to grade level in a year, but it took like real work between us. And like, how do we actually do that work with parents in like a really, really coordinated way, not in some sort of random program and none of that, but like as the actual work of the district, I think is like real work. And for all of Minneapolis Public Schools' faults, and Lord knows it's a struggling district with a huge achievement gap, is that the commitment to educating adults was actually real, right? And we had 100 different languages spoken in our schools, and we did a lot of work with their parents to like equip them. Again, achievement gap still big, but like, what does it look like to make those commitments?
So the first part of your question, I'd say yes. We know there's research about a 30,000 word gap between families who fall into your first category and challenging families. And so if I'm to take this example, one thing that we can do is that a lot of poor people actually own a phone or some type of handheld device. Instead of physically shipping books, which costs and all the things that come with it, actually have an app where you can send the book to a home. The parent can either read to the child, or if the parent is having challenges with reading as well, guess what? Your phone can read to the child, and you can even find language and diction to either fit your ethnicity, your interest, or your lifestyle and move forward. So there's ways of dealing with that.
And if I could just chime in on the extracurricular piece, I like to call it the activity gap. And one other problem is that wealthy parents, they're spending more on their kids than ever before. Mm-hmm. You know, parents are the parents who have the money are paying for all kinds of enriching activities for kids. And so that's also contributing to the gap because they're pulling further and further away from the poorer kids.
Mm-hmm. And just a final note on that piece is what many may not realize is that the achievement gap between races has actually diminished pretty progressively over the last several decades. But the achievement gap between poverty or between income levels has actually expanded over time, and it's now greater than the racial gaps.
This woman in the black blazer, yeah.
I'm Julia Clark from the National Science Foundation, and I can't believe it. After over 60 years with the Brown versus Brown, we're still talking about the achievement gap. I did write a book two years ago on closing the achievement gap from an international perspective, where we looked at different countries who had gaps and what the countries were doing to close the gap. And when I look at the achievement gap, or when I look at education or in the schools, there are two major things I think contributed to the gaps, and that's equity and access. And I know you focus more today on teachers and quality teachers. They are important, that's a key, but there are a lot of other factors. There's a lack of a rigorous curriculum for African-American and Latinos and American Indians or students. There's a lack of funding in those schools as well. They have equipment. They don't have equipment like other schools do. And you did mention about the lack of training of teachers. We do also have a digital divide. So we have less access to a lot of things in the school that contributes to the achievement gap. And we do fund projects at the National Science Foundation, after school programs and teacher preparation and in service. And it's not that these students, and students from low socioeconomic also have problems. And it's not that these students can't do when we provide enriching, innovative type of activities for these students. They can do just as well or better than many other schools. And we had one example of that is in Bronx School of Science in New York. And when one of the projects I funded took students from the inner city school and placed them in the Bronx School of Science, and they did just as well or better than some of the other schools. So I think it's a lack of opportunity for many of our minority students.
Hi, I'm Maddie Jire, and I used to be on the school board in Howard County, and I currently work in tech in San Francisco. I'm really curious about the whole idea of access, specifically looking at gifted education and the role that that plays in heavily segregating schools. We didn't really get to talk a lot about that today, but I'm curious about the different roadblocks that are given to a lot of students. For example, in Howard County at the school that I attended, it was a fairly diverse school, and I was one of two Black students in AP classes. Right. And I didn't do well on the gifted and talented test, and I pretty much failed it, and I ended up becoming an AP scholar. So what other methods are available, do you think, to identify particularly students from disadvantaged backgrounds? And when you think about access, my school had over 30 AP classes, so they're there, but I wouldn't be allowed to actually partake in them. So imagine for so many students, because I don't think I'm an anomaly. I mean, there are so many students that have these situations. What else could we do to reduce those barriers? One of the things that I worked on was to remove waivers that were placed for students, because that's what happened to me. But I don't think that that's the only problem there. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think that for us, in my organization, one of the things that we focused on consistently over the years has been ensuring that all children have access to high standards, because we feel that if you increase the level of standards, and we support, for example, the Common Core State Standards, not as a political issue, but because these standards are benchmarked international standards. And the structure of the standards themselves ensure that if they're carried out appropriately, kids will learn at much higher levels. So you really have to start almost from the beginning. I think the issue with gifted and talented programs is that we've never, ever been able to figure out how we get kids who are Latinos or African Americans and identify them for those programs. Right. And so we know that, you look at a kid in third grade and you have lots of white kids being pushed into these programs where their parents are actually taking them to classes and preparing them. You test Latino or Black kids and they don't do as well. And yet at the end, they're just as prepared. So we feel that having high standards, having really excellent curricula and outstanding teachers prepares everyone to be able to go on and participate in advanced courses when they're in high school like you did.
And two things. One is that, the public conversation around differentiation is often about it's about like our middle performers, right? It's like, how do we get the kids who are really struggling to like meet somebody's standard? We often don't talk about our kids who are doing really well in those classrooms, and like, how do we make sure they continue to do really well, which is in and of itself like real differentiation work that's not easy, especially in big classes. So I think that you are right, and we need to have more public conversation about that. The second is that people often don't talk about the social capital. I remember when I was in high school, like white parents would walk in and be like, my kid's gonna be in algebra 2. My father would never walk into anybody's school and be like whatever the teacher said was, he was like, if the teacher calls, the teacher's always right. I'm like, Daddy, that is nuts. But that was real for him. And I think that there have to be some structural fixes that we can do to that might be burdensome, right? Like, what does it mean to flag every single kid and put them against this bar and see if they could be, like, I think that it might be sort of an out of the ordinary, but I think that might be the right thing. I think in Minneapolis, we were not hiring teachers of color. It was really bad. And we made the commitment. We were like, we're going to interview every single teacher that applies, which was like a wild commitment. And it took us, it was not easy to do, but we did it. And it changed the face of teaching in Minneapolis because we were missing people, right? Because their resumes were like, there were typos. It was all this stuff. And we're like, we're like, if you can't even send it in right, like, this is rough. But we made this commitment. We were like, we're going to interview every single person that applies. And like, that was a burden for us, but we thought it was the right thing for kids. And like, how do we make more of those bets when we think about like doing the right things for kids?
So a few things. Number one, your story, you're not an anomaly. It's a story that people know. There's two scholars, one at Vanderbilt, one at Indiana, published a report, I believe, in the last 2 weeks to show that one of the strongest correlation between how many kids will get placed into gifted is having a Black teacher. Now, that's interesting because you're not going to radically make all the teachers Black in the United States and therefore get more kids in. But it's an interesting story to read because it raises a narrative that we should often think about where there's stereotype bias or other factors. That's number one. Going to your point about students who graduate, a lot of the students who finish summa cum laude, magna cum laude, were kids who were gifted. But you also have students who graduated from college thank the Lottie. You know, these were the ones who these were the ones you overlooked because they were, did not test well, but they were gifted. They had the grit or whatever else we want to call it. So there's some nuances that we could look at and change in policy, but that study is worth looking at.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Sorry, folks, but look forward to engaging on Twitter, and I'm sure these folks would like to engage with you, too. And thank you all for coming. It was a great discussion. Thanks for your questions.